I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Happy October 1st, 2013. It is a great day here in New York City. It's almost like summer, but it isn't summer because the leaves are actually changing, which seems a little early for the season, but it's beautiful. And because of everything I'm going to be talking about in the next hour, I couldn't help but get out for a run before I started this show. You'll know why in a moment. And October 1st is a really important day all around. It's World Vegetarian Day, in case you forgot, so get your cards out. And it's the day when we are going to debunk a lot of myths. So let's just jump right in with Dr. Ruth Heydrich, who has a great new book out called Lifelong Running, which she has written with Martin Rowe, who we've had on the program before, the co-founder of Lantern Books. And Ruth, at 70 years young, is a seasoned raw vegan Ironman, or as she likes to say, Iron Lady, triathlete. She's the winner of more than 900 trophies, 6 Ironman triathlons, 8 gold medals in the U.S. Senior Olympics, and 67 marathons, including Boston, New York, and Moscow. Named one of the 10 fittest women in North America. She's also a breast cancer survivor and author of A Race for Life, Senior Fitness, The Chef Cookbook, Raw Book, and her most recent book, Lifelong Running, How to Overcome the 11 Myths of Running and Live a Healthier Life. So glad to have you on the program, Ruth.
Yes. Hi. Happy to be here, Karen.
Yes. Now, I know you don't remember this because you meet a lot of people, but I met you in the mid-90s at some veg conference somewhere. I don't even remember where it was. But I was introduced to you and your inspiring story and just everything you're all about. You really are a game changer and leading the world, not just for women, but for everyone on this planet. And it's just an honor to have you on the program.
It's my honor to be on your program. Thank you.
So I just finished reading the book, and you know, it's funny. Every time I talk to an athlete and read their book, all I want to do is go out and exercise. And it's not that I don't exercise. I do exercise regularly, but it's great to get that extra inspiration, that kick in the butt, just a new page, a new white canvas to start new and fresh. And I thank you for that. Now, you probably know that today is, month, is not only World Vegetarian Day.
Oh, it's Breast Cancer Awareness.
It's that Breast Cancer Awareness. And do you have pink fatigue, pink rivet fatigue, like so many of us do?
You know, I just finished an interview about Stink the Pink. What a racket. What a racket this is,
yeah,
and
it is.
The salaries these people make, and how come there's not any progress, and that's because they don't care about prevention of breast cancer or prostate cancer or any of leukemia, MS, Alzheimer's. It is such a moneymaker.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's really sad because they motivate people to raise funds and then it goes nowhere because they either don't care or don't believe that the answer is in prevention. And if prevention is too late, reversal. The right diet and exercise program is the answer to almost all of our medical problems.
Amen. I know that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't believe in any conspiracy theories, and I don't want to look on the negative side of humanity, although we can be pretty ugly most of the time. But I like to think that there's good in all of us, and I really don't want to believe that those that are pushing pink ribbons and breast cancer awareness have a secret agenda. I want to think that they really are ignorant, or they have something in them that doesn't want to believe that it's as easy as diet and exercise our health and longevity.
Yeah, because even if you're not involved in one of those programs, the general population still believes that it can't be diet, that diet isn't powerful enough. And in fact, that was the main motivation for my doing an Ironman triathlon. When I changed my diet after the breast cancer diagnosis and saw how powerful it was, not just for the cancer, but for my high cholesterol, for my arthritis, for my constipation, for my adult acne, for my energy levels, I said, I've got to show people. This is really powerful. And I thought, doing an Ironman, that ought to get people's attention. And it did. It did. However, when you look at the progress, since my first one 30 years ago, yeah, there's been some progress, but not nearly as much as I would like. And there's still all these myths about running, how it ruins your knees, and people say, you know, one of the fears I had about the title of Lifelong Running was that people walking by and seeing it on a shelf would think, oh, that doesn't apply to me.
Exactly. You know? Right.
And I think that's going to be 90% of the population. And I thought, how are we going to get people to look past that, and instead of thinking, but I'm not a runner, how they can look at kids and say, we all started as runners. Why did we quit? And
exactly.
How easy it is to get started again.
Well, there's a lot of different things I want to bring up in the book that I found really inspirational. But just to finish this cancer conversation, you were a runner when you were diagnosed with breast cancer in your 40s. And
yep.
Exercise is so important, but it's only one piece, and diet is the other piece, obviously.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I know I had my personal experience with advanced ovarian cancer in 2006, and I had been a lifelong vegan, and not lifelong, I became vegan at 30, actually, and I was a vegetarian after 15. And I was eating pretty healthfully, and after my diagnosis, I definitely changed things. But I realized that my diet had kept me alive. I think I had been living with the disease a very long time. But one thing that surprised me was after my surgery, and I didn't even know I had cancer before I went in for surgery, my doctor couldn't stop saying, what are you doing? What are you eating? You are so clean inside. So I had this giant tumor, but everything else was perfect.
Yeah. Well, as a vegetarian, were you doing dairy?
I was eating dairy until I was 30 years old, but then I got the cancer at 48 or 47. So it was. I have my own explanation of things of why it happened, but I'm still a big believer in the power of food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I had been a runner for 14 years at that point and had done marathons and thought that that made me invulnerable to any disease. But what a shock I got. And Dr. McDougall, the doctor that got me to change my diet because of his clinical research in the area, said, you know, with a cholesterol of 236, you're at as great a risk of dying of a heart attack as you are the breast cancer. And I'm saying, wait just a darn minute. Mm-hmm. I'm a marathoner.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't impress him. You know, he said, no, look, you're your blood work is so clear right here. But don't worry, because it's not too late, which is my great fear. And sure enough, 17 days later, my cholesterol, well, the next reading was 160, and the one after that was 129. So that really lowered my risk of heart disease as well as the cancer.
Amazing, and amazing how fast and forgiving the body can be as soon as you stop taking in the crap and start taking in the good stuff.
Exactly.
All right, let's get to the running part, because this is amazing, and I want to just touch lightly on the myths so that people get a taste for wanting to read the book, because whether you're a runner or not, I think this is really a great read, and I really like the balance that Martin Rowe offers in the book, because I was inspired by your writing, but I know other people that would say, oh, my God, this is too much. It's not for me. You know, she's just amazing, and I'm not that person. And that's where Martin comes in and gives a totally different perspective of someone who never thought he was a runner and got totally wrapped up in it.
Yeah. I was so happy to see that.
Yeah. Well, you know, he gave a discussion in the foreword, and I imagine it's true, but I know Martin, and I never thought of him as a couch potato or anything like that. So I think he was using a little poetic license or something. Anyway, let's start at the beginning. We're humans, and we are meant to run.
Born to run. Yep.
Born to run. From little children that are always, well, as soon as they can, they just take off.
Yes. Yep. And they don't know how to walk.
Right.
It's either full speed or none at all.
Yeah, but then somehow we learn how to sit down and lay down and get in a car and slow everything down.
Yes.
To our detriment.
Yep. Yep.
I liked how you mentioned running errands.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And here in New York City, where many of us don't have cars, we do a lot of walking. And often I like to say, you know, I'm going for a run, and I'll usually start the run by going to the bank, depositing a check, and then running somewhere else, and then really getting, once I've warmed up, get into the rest of the run. And I'm running errands.
Yeah. What a wonderful idea. We could all do that.
Yeah. Now, I think your most important message is the fact that you're 78.
Mm-hmm.
And you are in amazing physical shape. And you're doing so much. And all these things that people think are not possible at your age.
I know. Yeah, I look at my peers. It's pretty sad.
People don't want to get up. They don't want to walk. They don't want to move. And they have all kinds of aches and pains. And that's from not moving.
Yeah, exactly. Yep, the body is meant to move, and if it doesn't, it atrophies, and you start losing muscle mass, you lose bone density, you lose the capacity to extract oxygen from the air, from your lungs, your blood doesn't carry as much oxygen, your brain starts deteriorating, it's head to toe, falling apart.
Now, a lot of people say they're too tired, or they have an injury, and they come up with all kinds of excuses not to move and not to run. But my understanding through your book, and especially through your experiences with some serious accidents, exercise is critical to healing.
Yes, it is. Absolutely. Because it stimulates the circulation, which gives more nutrients and oxygen to the injured parts. And in fact, you know, if you injure a tendon or ligament and don't do anything, if you just stabilize it, the healing will take place, but it's the cells attach randomly, whereas if you put light stress on them, they realign in straight lines, the length of the tendon or the ligament. So slight exercise is always good, even though it may hurt, you do a little bit. The tricky part is not doing too much, and I've been known to do that too.
And how do you know what too much is?
That's the tricky part. Pain isn't always a guide, because I remember after getting hit by that truck while cycling that my physical therapist says, this is going to hurt. I'm sorry I have to do this, but we got to get that leg straight. They put a titanium rod in it because the bones were so shattered from the impact of the truck. And she just worked me to the point I was screaming, and she said, I hate to do it, but she did it anyway, and I thank her for that. So that's an extreme example. Most injuries are not nearly that serious, and sometimes a couple of days rest is necessary, but stay as active as possible. In fact, you know, when they took me to the hospital in an ambulance, and the next day, you know, orthopedic wards sometimes have these little triangle bars above the head so you can lift yourself up to get on the bedpan.
Yeah.
I was doing pull-ups on those. The nurse walked around the corner, came in, and she said, what in the world are you doing? And I said, I'm doing pull-ups. I can exercise my upper body, even if I can't do the lower body.
Yeah, and hospital is a tough place to be in.
Oh, boy. But you can do it. Mm-hmm. I devised a set of exercises you can do lying down, whether it's lying down, sitting, standing. You can always contract muscles, whether it's your glutes. My favorite one to tell people to do is your Kegels. You know what Kegels are, right?
Please tell us what they are.
They are the muscles that control the perineum, the bottom of the pelvic floor, urination, and prevent fecal and dribbling, incontinence. So, and that's a problem as people age, and that's why adult diapers are commonly advertised, and we can keep those muscles strong. So this is an exercise you can do. You and I can do them right now.
Right now, I'm doing them right now.
Yeah, yeah.
Sitting down.
And they help. Yep, and if that's not motivation enough, they help with making more powerful orgasms. So
that's right.
That should get people's attention. And so whether you exercise those little tiny muscles down there or the big quads and the glutes and the abs, those are the ones that show that make you look fit and feel strong and healthy. So just exercise is so important.
Well, you know, it's funny you brought that up. There are a number of big industries, and health is one of them, or disease care is one of them. And and another is things that are related to sex and all the drugs that are out there to improve sexual performance, whereas if people realize that they stopped eating the foods that are bad for them and ate the foods that were good for them, they wouldn't need those drugs anymore.
Yep, if these foods are clogging those critical arteries and you stop eating those foods, those critical arteries down there open up again. And that's,
you know,
and if you don't do that, that's the first sign of heart disease, actually, impotence and lower libido. It means something's going wrong, and that's like the canary in the coal mine. If you don't get it when it's early, it's just going to keep progressing. And conversely, if you nip it in the bud, it can reverse completely, and you don't ever have to have heart disease. Most cancers, diabetes, osteoporosis, arthritis, dementia. What have I missed?
Well, everything that the chronic disease is plaguing people today, multiple sclerosis, the whole host of them, yeah.
Yeah, that's a good one, yep.
It's a bad one, but what's really unfortunate is most people have no idea that diet can really turn that disease around significantly.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I've seen it.
With MS, you need to have a very low-fat diet, and the research of Dr. Roy Swank has been out there for, 40 years, and people still are being diagnosed with MS. They're doing the walk for MS to raise funds for it. Here we already have the, if not a complete cure, at least a management of the disease and to keep it from progressing.
That's
and
right.
This is true of most all the chronic disease, all the drugs that Big Pharma promotes. Most of them have to do with blood pressure, high cholesterol, and blood sugar. Those three are managed perfectly well by the right diet, the one we're talking about, vegan, low-fat, raw as much as possible, and vigorous exercise that gets your heart rate up and gets you pumping blood and breathing hard. And running is the most effective and efficient way to do that. Within a few minutes, you got your blood pressure under control and your heart rate going and oxygen and I just can't say enough about it, and that's why Martin asked me to write the book. He knows how enthusiastic I am.
Well,
I've been running now for 45 years.
Wow.
Don't plan to ever stop.
What I like about running, I like a lot of things about it. I'm not one that at this point in my life, it can always change, but I don't see myself running in competitions. But what I like about running is how easy it is in terms of practicality. I like riding a bike, but I have to get my bike out of the basement. I have to pump up the tires. I have to clean it off a little bit, and there's a little too much activity there. And I love to swim, but I've got to get to a pool.
Oh, yeah.
Running, you just leave your door.
With biking, you can't do it just anywhere. It's dangerous, as I've found out.
Oh, yeah.
You really need a trail where there are no cars.
Yeah, I'm
and
petrified
swimming, yeah,
here
you're
in
right.
the city.
You've got to have a pool or an ocean close
right.
by. So running, you can do anywhere, anytime.
And there have been a handful of occasions where the weather has just been so horrible outside. And I have run in the snow and the rain, but sometimes I just run inside the house.
Yep.
It's up and down somewhere. You can do it anywhere.
You don't have to have a treadmill. They do make it easier to keep track of your speed, and you can have the incline. But you can run around the house and anywhere. You can run in place, for gosh sakes.
Mm-hmm. I was I finished your book this morning, and then I, of course, I had a run because I just couldn't stand reading this book without running. I run a few times a week, but I tried the 100 up.
Oh yeah, every time I hit a stop sign, I'm doing it right now, sitting, just raising the legs up like that. Keep them moving when you're sitting, and then stretch the quads by doing them back. So glad you did that. Thanks.
Yes. We can all be moving while we're listening. Now, I know there are these people that are starting to get desks where they stand up or they stand on a treadmill and work at a desk. I can't see myself quite doing that, but I guess it's good for some people.
Yeah.
The point is to keep moving or to get some motion in your life.
Absolutely.
All right, now, let's talk a little bit about food. Because that's an important piece, I think. And you have a particular diet that you like. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, to sum it up, it's a low-fat, vegan, mostly raw diet consisting of fruits and vegetables, lots of leafy greens. I like the big, big bags of mixed organic greens. I love kale. I love broccoli. There are so many benefits to these leafy greens, so they are actually the major part of my breakfast, and I know that's shocking to a lot of people. In fact, when Chris McDougall was writing his book, Born to Run, he's got my story in there, and when he was interviewing me, he asked me the same thing, tell me what you eat, and when I told him greens for breakfast along with mango and banana, he was kind of shocked, and he said, I've never heard of anybody eating a salad for breakfast.
Mm.
And I said, well, you know, it's not really a salad. This is a large quantity of greens and fruit. And so he thought, I'll try it. And guess what? He loves it.
He's
been doing it ever since. So leafy greens get you, because of their high nutrient-calorie ratio, they're one of the healthiest foods you can eat. Why not get them in your body first thing in the morning? That was why I tried it. Plus, I got to work at the 1988 Olympics in Seoul, Korea. Mm-hmm. And as a trainer there, I got to eat in the Olympic Village where all the athletes from all these different countries ate. So I'd walk around and see what they ate. It was only the Americans who had things like bacon and eggs and egg McMuffin and all these high-fat, high-animal foods, whereas the Japanese, the Chinese, even the Russians, and most of the other countries had veggies, veggies and some kind of starch, mostly in the Asian countries, rice, and in the African countries, it's potatoes and corn. They know how to eat breakfast, and so that was another motivation for me to keep up with the greens for breakfast. But I don't stop the greens there. I also have them with every meal, as that makes up the basis of my even my supper, which is the greens with tomato and bell pepper. I love the red bell peppers. I love purple cabbage, cauliflower. Ginger. I have I take the whole ginger root and cut up little tiny slices and probably 10 or 15 of them and mix them throughout both my breakfast and supper. And it adds this nice little tang.
Raw.
Plus ginger is, raw.
Wow.
Is an anti-inflammatory. No, if you have the slices thin, it's just that nice little ting.
Okay, because it can get hot.
Oh, yeah, if you get too much at a time.
Good.
But if you mix it up with all your fruits and vegetables and leafy greens, it really is good. I love it.
I love ginger with greens. It works.
Yep, it sure does.
It's funny,
my beverage is just water is nature's perfect beverage, as I say in my Cook Raw book. I do like green tea and stevia as any kind of a sweetener. So one of my favorite drinks is 100% pure cocoa, a rounded teaspoon of that with a tiny little bit of stevia and a green tea bag. I call this cocoa tea. Mm-hmm. And boy, is that ever healthy. The antioxidants in both the green tea and the cocoa, it is, in fact, I'm sipping on some now.
You should probably bag that and call it Dr. Ruth's tea.
Yeah, I probably could.
There we go.
It is in my cookbook, that recipe. Mm-hmm. And for dessert, can't forget dessert because I do have a sweet tooth. And I love blueberries. And again, the nutrient calorie ratio, berries are way up at the top. So I have a large bowl, half blueberries and half prunes. Why prunes? Not necessarily for the regularity aspect of it. I found out when I went vegan that took care of that little problem.
Yeah.
But because prunes have been shown to keep bones strong.
Oh.
And there's some research, and I'm not sure how it works, but the research shows that if you eat 8 to 10 prunes a day, it will reverse osteoporosis and prevent it, get greater bone density. Again, I'm not sure why. It doesn't work with raisins and dates.
Prunes.
This experimenter tried it with all these different fruits, and it was only prunes. So ever since I read that, and that was probably 5 years ago, I've been
eating prunes.
Those prunes. Yeah, yep.
I'm
now,
definitely going to look into that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think maybe if you try Googling, I ought to do that.
I will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Running, of course, is the best way to keep bones strong as you age, because we know that people will lose bone density as they age if they don't keep running. And it's the impact. That's one of the myths, that impact is bad and you want low or no impact. And I say just the opposite. You want as much impact as possible, because that impact is what stimulates the osteoblasts, and the osteoblasts are your bone-building cells. You want those working.
Now, you mentioned, too, knee injuries before, and if we just touch on that myth with impact on mm-hmm. knees, people believe that running isn't good for the knees.
Yeah, and the opposite, again, is true. The research has shown that runners have no more knee injuries, no more arthritis in the knees than non-runners. And this is a long-standing research study done at Stanford University.
Mm.
So I challenge anybody to challenge them. You know, they know what they're doing. And because there was as much arthritis in both runners and non-runners, I say, you know, if all of those runners, that over 1,000 population of runners, had been vegan, they wouldn't have any arthritis at all.
I think that's a really important point.
Yeah.
Really important.
It is. Yep. Arthritis is the body's inflammatory response to foreign proteins. And by golly, if another human being's proteins in our body are considered foreign, which they really are, you know, we don't do heart, lung, tissue transplants unless the tissues are matched, and even then, our body will reject them, and that's why we take anti-rejection drugs for the rest of our life to keep that heart or kidney or whatever. So if you can imagine, if a human has this much of a problem, think what a cow, a pig, or a fish, or a bird protein in our bodies. Now, they're not supposed to get in our bloodstream, but because of leaky guts that a lot of people have, they do get in the bloodstream, they get in the joints, and therefore we have a diagnosis of arthritis, and it's so common that doctors will say, well, you know, by the age of 30, most everybody gets some arthritis. And in fact, that's what I was told with my arthritis, and they said, oh, don't worry, we've got this new drug that's perfect for this. And that was naproxen at the time. This is back in the 70s when I was diagnosed with the arthritis. Took it for a bunch of years until I started having GI bleeding. And that's when Dr. McDougall said, why in the world are you taking that drug? And I said, it's for my arthritis. And he said, stop the drug right now. Your arthritis went away when you went vegan. And sure enough,
wow.
It did. And now, of course, that drug is over-the-counter as Aleve and very commonly taken by people for the slightest little ache or pain, and they don't know that they can prevent it.
just by what they're eating. I remember Dr. McDougall back in the, when I first started listening to him, probably in the 80s or something, and just hearing how angry he would get at the arthritis associations because they refused to connect, make the connection with diet.
Yep.
But I think finally they're doing that. Well, Ruth, we've come to the end of the half hour.
Whoa.
And that was fast. The time ran by.
I do have a website that
has
recently been redone. And Audrey Weil just took over and said, we need to update your website. And I said, go to it. She did, and I love it. It's my name, RuthHeidrich.com, RuthHeidrich.com.
I just have one quick question for you.
Sure.
Maybe it's not that quick, but what are your future goals for athletic performance?
Oh boy, just to keep going. Part of what I've noticed as I'm looking at 80 is definitely slowing down. And whereas my goal up until fairly recently was to keep improving, getting better, faster, whatever, now it's changing just to maintain.
You know? Okay. Well, you've gotten to an amazing point that maintaining where you're at is pretty amazing.
Yeah, well... That's the way it is.
Good.
I have no choice. and probably another book or two. I would love to have a book called Running Round the World, because with all the fantastic places I've run, I want to show people how to see this planet on your feet and enjoying it much better that way.
Well, yeah, I agree. That's the way I like to travel. Just get the hotel and unpack and go out for a run, and you see things that most people don't see.
Exactly. Yep.
Thank you for joining me on It's All About Food, and all the best with the book Lifelong Running and your Lifelong Running, and inspiring everybody else to do the same.
Thank you for having me, Karen.
Okay, take care.
Yep. Right. Bye.
Bye. That was Dr. Ruth Heidrich, author of Lifelong Running with Martin Rowe, and a very fun and inspiring book. We're taking a break now, and then we're going to talk about the calorie myth. We just finished with the running myths. On to the calorie myths with Jonathan Baylor. We'll be right back. Hello, everybody. We're back, and it's October 1st, 2013. Thank you for joining me today on It's All About Food, Debunking Myths. And there are so many myths out there. We could spend a long time debunking them because so many of them get into our core, they get into our skin, and we really believe them as fact. But we're all here on this planet, I think, to learn, experience joy, move forward, improve ourselves, and some of that means learning that some things that we always believe to be true are not. Hey, you know, there was a time when we all thought the world was flat, right? I think it isn't. Anyway, let's go on and talk about the calorie myth with Jonathan Baylor. Collaborating with top scientists for over 10 years, analyzing over 1,300 studies, synthesizing over 10,000 pages of research, and garnering endorsements by top doctors from Harvard Medical School, Johns Hopkins, Yale, and UCLA, Jonathan Baylor is a preeminent nutrition and exercise expert and former personal trainer who specializes in utilizing high-quality food and exercise to simplify health and fitness. He has registered over 25 patents and authored the revolutionary upcoming The Calorie Myth. And he serves as senior program manager at Microsoft, hosts a popular syndicated wellness radio show, blogs on the Huffington Post, and consults for organizations around the world. His free 28-day quick start eating and exercise guide is available at BaylorGroup.com. A summa cum laude and Phi Beta Kappa graduate of DePaul University, Baylor lives outside of Seattle with his wife, Angela, and works to enable others to live better through simple, proven science. Sounds good to me. Welcome to It's All About Food, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, it's good talking to you again.
Absolutely. I so enjoyed having you on my show and appreciate you reciprocating the love.
Yes. So let me put my disclaimers out there so we can get to the meat of the conversation or the vegetable of the conversation. we both are aligned on so many issues. I am a vegan and Jonathan is not. But we are promoting so many of the same things, and it's so important that this alignment is there and we can focus on those things, because as more and more people see the power of healthy, minimally processed plant foods in their life and getting rid of the junk, we will all get to a better place. How's
that? Absolutely. Absolutely. Absolutely, Karen. And what I like to tell people, and just to add on to what you said, is regardless of vegan, vegetarian, kosher, halal, low carb, high carb, medium carb, whatever it is, there's a way to do that that's in line with proven science to further your health. And there's a way to do that as the media and the marketers will have you believe.
Mm-hmm.
And you and I are right aligned with however we want to eat. Let's make sure we're doing it in line with science and in line with responsibility with the planet.
There you go. All right, let's talk about this thing called the calorie. Now, I don't know when the calorie was actually discovered or when we first recognized it existed. But we're learning more and more about it. I think the calorie is actually a kilocalorie, is it not?
It is. It was never intended to be something. It's being treated as the lowest common denominator, the great equalizer, right? You could eat 100 calories of ding-dongs, or you could eat 100 calories of broccoli. And in either case, if you just go walk at this pace for this period of time, you're net neutral, and everything is the same. Obviously, that is not true. And we know that's not true.
That's so not true. That's such a myth. It's fascinating what we're learning, and we will continue to learn, because I think humans in general are just at the beginning of a long journey of active learning. And in terms of nutrition, we're really just at the starting point. And what's fascinating for me is how calories have become important, and you can definitely develop this a little bit more. But for a long time, people were thinking about the volume of food, how much volume or weight, and not really realizing that it was the calorie. And now we're realizing maybe it's more than the calorie.
That's absolutely correct. That's absolutely correct. One key thing for us to all keep in mind, because we've been so bombarded with counting calories, how many calories are in this, you need to burn calories, is remember that nobody, except for some very few scientists, up until 40 years ago, had any idea what a calorie was, and we were all slimmer, and we were all healthier before that. Right?
So,
like,
mm-hmm.
Like, I don't mean to, like, blow the roof off right in the beginning, but call me crazy, but, I mean, we're smarter than every other animal on this planet, and they also don't know what calories are, and they seem to stay diabetes-free and to stay at a healthy weight without counting them either. So I think we may have been fed a bit of a load of baloney here, which is not helping us.
I agree we shouldn't be counting calories, but I just have to step aside for a moment as a scientist and just say that a lot of things have happened over the last 40, 50, 60 years that point to why we're fatter. And counting calories, I think, was a method, a way of dealing with us getting fatter, but a lot of nasty things have been going on. We've been creating these foods that aren't really foods. People have been convinced to eat these highly processed things with lots of salt, sugar, and fat, and very little calories. And certain foods have been made cheaper by all kinds of food subsidies, and there's just so many different things that have been happening. Plus, there's all kinds of plastics and stuff and things that are out there that affect us, and some of them affect our appetite. I mean, it's really mind-boggling. But if we get back to simplicity, we really can solve a lot of problems.
And it's important. Your point is well heard, because I'm not one of those people that are saying calories are like unicorns. They don't exist. Like, if you eat 10,000 calories worth of anything, well, if you eat 10,000 calories worth of broccoli, your stomach would explode way before you became obese. But if you were able to eat 10,000 calories, you would gain fat. But this is, we are eating too many calories. In fact, researchers at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill discovered in 2011, they did this amazing study where the average person today is consuming about 570 more calories than the average person. And, of course, who is the average person? But it's interesting data. Mm-hmm. Back in 1977.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, wow, doesn't that just prove that we're all gaining weight because we're eating too many
more
calories? But hold on. If we actually do the calorie math that we're all taught, if you actually add up the amount of calories, like over 40 years that should be, and then the amount of weight we should have gained, the average American today should weigh well over 1,100 pounds. Right, from 2006 to 2011 alone, the average American should have gained 476 pounds, according to calorie math.
Oh, okay, so something's wrong with the equation.
Exactly, and we have gained weight. On average, we've gained about 20 pounds. But that's 98% less than calorie math would have us believe. So it's not that calories are irrelevant. It's just that they might be a small fraction, as you mentioned, of a much bigger picture. So if anyone says, just have this 100-calorie snack pack, it's only 100 calories, run the other direction.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are so many different games that they play with calories, too, to deceive people. Putting serving sizes on labels and saying there are a certain amount of calories, and people never eat those serving sizes. They eat a lot more. So things can be really mm-hmm. deceiving if you're counting calories, which is why it's important not to.
And the other really liberating thing, once you can free yourself from counting those calories, not only can you sit down at the table and enjoy food instead of doing math, because I don't know about you, but when I sit down and I'm hungry, the last thing I want to do is math, is you avoid the following horrible myth. Okay, eat that 100-calorie snack pack, because then you could just go jog for 15 minutes and it's like you didn't do anything. That's analogous. Like when you actually look at what these quote-unquote edible products do to us, that's like saying, hey, Karen, I'm going to smoke 2 packs of cigarettes, but it's okay because I'm going to go jog afterwards, and that cancels it out, right?
Yeah, I don't like thinking that way. We have a law in New York State regarding fast food establishments that they have to put the calorie and nutritional information on every meal. And I don't eat in your typical fast food restaurant, or I think it's fast food and chain restaurant. So there's this one restaurant in New York City called Le Pain Quotidien, which Americans might read it as Le Pain Quotidien. But it's Le Pain Quotidien, which means the daily bread. And it's a really nice chain in New York City. I don't know where else they are, but they serve a lot of really lovely, fresh, locally sourced, from sustainable sources, some very nice selections. But because they fit in this category, they show on the menu all the calorie and nutritional information for every meal. And frankly, I find it disturbing that it's there, because I start looking at, rather than the food and what I feel like eating, I look, oh, this is 450 calories. Oh, this is 259 calories. And I was like, whoa, what am I looking at here, and why am I looking at it? I don't like it.
There's also this just misunderstanding. Like what you said is so true. It's about food. It's about food. Humans, we're here to eat food, not to think about calories. And it also, there's this hubris involved. I love earlier we were talking about this humility. We're just starting to learn these things. Bottom line, no one's going to go through life hungry. And bottom line, you need to eat a certain amount of energy or you're going to be hungry. So this thought that like somehow you can deceive your body into eating less than it needs to fuel itself and that you won't be hungry, like it's a manipulative mindset. You can trick your body, and that's not, the body is brilliant. The body doesn't need to be tricked. If you just feed the body food, nutrient dense food, it will keep you slim and healthy as it did for every previous generation that existed. We don't need to trick it. There's no trickery involved.
The thing with processed food, there's so many things that are wrong with so many things that come in a package or a box, but they don't, for the most part, have much water in them, and they're like dried and concentrated, not fresh, alive food. And when we eat it, we don't have that feeling that we get from a lot of food, plant foods that have fiber in them. We don't get that sated feeling. And our brains ultimately don't get the sated feeling either because they're not getting a lot of nutrition from these foods. And then the ultimate response is, feed me more.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about eating 10,000 calories of broccoli before, but you know, I like to tell a lot of people, if you want to lose weight, just eat a pound of greens raw, and then you can have whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I can't eat a pound of greens. That's the point.
That's the number one recommendation. I talk about a sane lifestyle or eating satisfying, unaggressive, nutritious, and inefficient foods. The single most important component, and the research backs this up unequivocally, is a mass amount of non-starchy vegetables. Like if listeners are going to take one thing away, and it's like everyone agrees on that, which is funny. Like even the most vehement paleo person and the most strict vegetarian, non-starchy vegetables. Vegetables you can eat raw.
Mm-hmm.
Green leafy vegetables, cucumbers, mushrooms. Like stop, I'm going to make a bold claim. Stop worrying about anything else until you're eating double digit servings of non-starchy vegetables per day. Like that one action will do more for your health, happiness, and appearance than anything else you could do.
What does that look like, double-digit servings?
Surprisingly, not that much.
In terms of the
day.
Not
that much.
Mm-hmm.
If you're, for example, if you don't saturate your breakfast with starch. So let's say you're someone who is an omnivore and you were to have an omelet that was stuffed with non-starchy vegetables. Cooked non-starchy vegetables are quite small, so it would be very easy for a normal person to eat three servings of vegetables with breakfast. You could also do a green smoothie. A lot of my vegetarian and vegan friends do green smoothies, and it's very easy. Again, that's three servings of non-starchy vegetables right there.
Mm.
Lunch, that's another thing. I mean, basically, if you can do three servings, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, you're there. And as long as you don't fill your plate with starch, it's really easy. Like when you start seeing vegetables as less of a side and more of the main dish, like don't put your stir fry on top of rice. Put it on top of a bed of vegetables. Don't put your curry on top of rice. Put it on top of a bed of vegetables, and you'll accidentally eat double-digit servings of non-starchy vegetables.
Now let's talk about starch for a minute, because there are some people that really promote a high whole carbohydrate diet versus focusing on non-starchy plant foods. And what does the science have to say about that?
You need calories. You need energy, and there's two primary sources of energy, fat and sugar. That's bottom line. And when you eat starch or you eat sugar, you're getting your source of calories from sugar, because they're all the same when they leave your stomach. And if you're eating more fat, then you get fat. So if you're eating a very low fat diet, you do need to get calories from someplace. You could get them from protein. That's not a good idea, because protein is a structural component. It's not a energy source.
Mm.
So you're going to have to eat more starch. I personally, and the research I've reviewed, generally errs more on the side of getting energy more, like at least in a balance between sugar and fat. But if you avoid fat for whatever reason, you have to eat. So I have no other options for you, or else you starve to death.
Well, there are people on a calorie-restricted diet. That's another conversation.
Absolutely. Well, and I think personally that you could be, especially for vegans and vegetarians, I mean, my favorite sources of fat, where I get my energy from, are plant fats. I could eat cocoa and coconut and chia seeds and flax seeds and avocados and macadamia nuts. I will gladly take 60% of my calories that I get in a day from those whole food, nutrient-dense, fiber-dense plant fats. And the research shows that that is one of the most therapeutic things you could be doing for your health.
Mm. Well, those all sound good to me.
And it's an underappreciated dietary lifestyle. I would love to see more attention placed upon a high-fat, higher fat, vegetarian, or vegan diet, where you swap those starch calories for whole food plant fats. I think that's a fascinating and a very promising way to live.
There's a number of studies that we need to have done, and they haven't been done for a number of reasons. One is it's costly to do the studies that are really going to be significant because they take a lot of people and they take a long time because it's not something that can be done over a short period of time, especially when we're using humans to do those studies, which we need to, and not animals because, or not other animals, because they're not the same as we are. So it's expensive. But I think a lot of the studies that have been done just really haven't understood a lot about nutrition because we're really at the beginning of learning about it. And not all protein is the same, not all fat is the same, not all carbohydrates are the same. And we need to differentiate that. So some studies on fat have really gotten the bad rap, but they haven't been getting fat necessarily from the best sources.
That is so key. Especially so many people, they talk about epidemiological studies or observational studies where you compare one population with another population, and there's thousands of variables. Mm. But then the media says, well, this group ate, just hypothetically, let's say this group ate more protein than this other group and they had a higher incidence of cancer. Okay, that might be very well true. But if that one group was also, let's say the high cancer group, let's say that their protein was coming from Spam and hot dogs, which no one would recommend, and they weren't eating any vegetables. Mm-hmm. Okay, so was it the protein that gave them cancer, or was it the toxic processed foods they were eating and the lack of vegetables, right? And you just got to unpack some of these things, because when you have those epidemiological studies, science 101 is minimize variables. Observational studies do not do that in any way, shape, or form.
That's just like when there are studies that come out that evaluate meat eaters versus vegetarians and vegans. Most of those are not good studies either, because you can be a junk food vegan or a healthy vegan or somewhere in the middle, the same with vegetarian, same with a meat eater, and we really need to be looking at the food, where it comes from, what the person's lifestyle is, and that's too many variables.
Well, my hope, my work is trying to simplify. That's my whole purpose on this earth, is to say there is, I don't care, plant, animal, whatever, how satisfying is it? Meaning, how quickly does it fill you up and how long does it keep you full? How aggressive is it? AKA, what's the blood sugar response? Is it overworking your pancreas or not? Is it nutritious? How many nutrients are you getting per calorie? It's a mathematical question. It's not a moral question. And then how efficient is it? Meaning, how readily can your body store it as fat? We can take every food in the world and just plot it on what I call the sanity spectrum. Plant, animal, doesn't matter. And it's not a moral discussion. It's just like saying, let's get a criteria. What is a high quality food? Let's establish that framework. And then let's all, whatever our moral inclinations, whatever our taste preferences, just try to stay as sane as we possibly can.
Try and stay as sane as we can?
Sane, satisfying, unaggressive, nutritious, and inefficient.
Oh, very good. Okay, we just have like a couple of minutes left. So your book, The Calorie Myth, doesn't come out until the end of the year, probably a good New Year's Eve kick in the butt type of book.
Exactly, yeah, it's New Year's Eve, but it is available for pre-order now online, so
okay,
you
great.
Could reserve your copy.
I didn't mean New Year's Eve. I meant for the New Year's resolutions that people always make, because so many of them do realize, okay, New Year, let's try and get healthier this year. And I say, why wait till New Year's? Let's start right now. And and people can visit your website at thebaylorgroup.com.
Exactly. We also have a free podcast. You can find it on iTunes. It's called The Smarter Science of Slim. And as you mentioned, Baylor Group, BAILOR Group, a massive amount of free resources. So no need to wait, like you said, till New Year's Eve to take control of your health.
And how did you get so smart?
Well, when you spend 12 years of your life reading research and having no friends or life, you know, you kind of,
yeah, I know. It's hard. I don't know how you feel about it, but I'm quite passionate about food, but I'm only interested in talking to people who want to the information. I'm not really looking for, well, it's hard to talk to people who aren't interested, and I think if we just focus on those who really want the information, that's a good place to go, an interested audience.
Absolutely, and I think when you said interested in the information is key, people who are seeing this as a productive area where we can make progress rather than like, I'm right and I have the answer, because at the end of the day, we're trying to be healthy, and frankly, if I meet Sally Smith on the street and she's got some genetic mutation which makes Pepsi and Cheetos healthy for her, and she can show, like, her, she gets her blood tested and it's like, wow, the more Pepsi and Cheetos she eats, the healthier she gets, and we can measure that. I'm like, you know what? I'm not going to say you're wrong. So let's just, whatever makes you healthy, do that and forget about everything else.
Yeah, it's all about what makes you feel good and happy and healthy. Right, I'm all for that. Jonathan, it's been a pleasure talking to you. It went really fast, and here we are at the end of the hour. So all the best to you and the calorie myth.
Thank you so much.
I recently read that, actually it was in my former guest's book, that it takes 17 years for health information to get out from the original science to the doctor and utilized. So I hope the information in the calorie myth takes a lot sooner to get absorbed into the public, because we need that information now.
Well, thank you very much.
Right. Take care, Jonathan. You've been listening
to
It's All About Food. I'm Karen Hartglass. Have a delicious week. Bye-bye.